made any sense. But every now and again, he says something which was worth waiting the 7 hours for. And that was another real Ajahn Chah. But of course, all that rubbish stuff has just been taken out and you've just got the jewels left. That's why, you know, when I read his books, this is an Ajahn Chah. This is just, you know, the nice stuff which he said. And that's actually the truth of the matter. And so one evening, he was giving one of these long, boring talks. And everybody had to sit down and listen. You know, in Thailand, the respect was so great, you weren't allowed to get up and leave. Not even if you were dying. You had to die there. So, and also, you know, in some of those monasteries, they have these little fellows, these little novices, who become monks for all sorts of different reasons. Either their parents are just too poor, or I remember this one novice whose father got so upset, killed his mother while he was in his mother's arms. So, you know, they go to the monastery. It's like a resort, a social safety net for little people. So it was one little novice. He was sitting there with everybody else. He knew he couldn't leave. And Ajahn Chah was going on and on and on. That's when this little novice started thinking, when is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When is he going to stop? When is he going to stop? And it became an obsessive thought. When is he going to stop? When is he going to stop? And it went on for a long time, apparently, until this little novice had an insight. This is what insights are. You see things in a different way. And you can't predict these insights, it just happens. And instead of when is Ajahn Chah going to stop, he had this insight, when am I going to stop? And that's when the little novice stopped. And when he opened his eyes, it was dawn. The monks had already gone out on arms round. He just opened his eyes, everybody had gone. At the end of the talk, they'd rang the bell, they'd done the chanting, bowed to Ajahn Chah. He hadn't heard anything of that. And he wasn't at all upset. He just had one of the nicest experiences of his little life. He'd stopped and got into one of these jhana states. Can't hear anything, can't feel his body, just having a wonderful time, this happy little novice monk. So, that's one way you can get into jhana. When am I going to stop? Stop it! And when you stop, you become still and all this stuff happens to you. That's a nice little story. So, this is actually what it's like to get into these jhana states. And there are lots and lots and lots of bliss and lots of stillness. And the nice thing about them, the other thing you can tell it's a jhana is how you feel afterwards. I did mention this in brief, that sometimes you come out afterwards and you come and see me and say, oh, Ajahn Brahm, yeah, I just had a jhana 5 minutes ago and it was very nice. And if you say it like that, as if it was just, you know, you've had a cup of tea and a biscuit, you know, the emotional afterglow is just not there. It wasn't a jhana. Because I have a huge emotional afterglow when you come out of a jhana, which sometimes lasts literally for days. Sometimes if you get one of those deep meditations, if you have one this morning, you won't be able to sleep tonight. You've got too much energy. You won't need to sleep. Your brain is just super powered. And also, you know, you may be not really interested in eating, because that's gross. You know, now it's just, you know, looking forward to lunch. But if you had a really powerful mind state, you know, that sort of stuff is a bit yucky. You'd only do that if you really have to. And it's the same, you have just beautiful, beautiful energy. And the other thing, that no one will be able to upset you if you get a phone call to say your father has passed away in somewhere other. Oh yeah. Well, that's a sign that you've got in these incredible powerful states. You know, all these so-called defilements have disappeared for a while. You just cannot have ill will. You cannot have fear. You cannot have anything. You're just totally peaceful. And this is one of the reasons why, that after the jhanas, they say these five hindrances which stop true insight have vanished. What the five hindrances are, just in brief, you've got like restlessness and also sloth and torpor. Sloth and torpor, the dullness, which is basically, you know, the lights aren't on in your mind, so you can't see much. like going out into the dark compared to going out into the middle of the day. That's the dullness. So after jhana, there's no dullness. Everything is incredibly clear. And all this restlessness, it stops you looking at things long enough to understand them. You know, sometimes we think of something and before the thought is finished, we want to another thought. Our problem is we never stay long enough with anything to really understand it. And the old simile, I haven't done this for a long time. This is an insight simile. What is this? Any idea? What is it? Please say.
Piece of wood,
yeah. What else is it? Thank you, Ronnie. Get it started. What else is it?
Stick.
Yeah, what else is it?
A stick.
Yeah, anything else? Give me more information.
Brown,
yeah. Give me more information. What else can you see?
Black.
What else can you see? Yeah, what else can you see? Now this is just a little exercise in perception, because when you first pick up something, you can just say it's a stick, and you stop looking any further, because you think you've captured it, you don't need to see it any longer, you've given it a name, finished and done. But when you hold it up and you say stick, and I force you, what else is there? What else? What else? What else? The longer you look, the more you see. It's as simple as that. It's not just a stick. There's a huge amount of information in here. But all we say is stick, we know it, and therefore we don't look further. Who is that? That's my enemy. You don't even look further. They're just my enemy. You've judged them, you've got them, you've nailed them, and so you don't even look any deeper to see the beautiful parts. You know, this is a stick, this is a flower. We all know what a flower is. Do you know what a flower is? So often the names give the illusion we've understood things. Is that Ajahn Brahm? No way. There's much more to this thing inside here than just a name, Ajahn Brahm. Of course there is. We give it a name, we think we've known it. That's one of the reasons why names hide the truth. Thoughts assume they've captured truth. It's an assumption, an illusion. When the thoughts stop, when I hold this up, and when you have run out of names, and you can't have any verbal concepts for what I'm holding up here, then there's a chance you might be able to start seeing something in here. And also, you can be very creative now. It's not just a stick, you can use it for all sorts of things, which you've never used before. Now this is where creativity, wisdom and truth come from. We stop giving these things damn names and think we know them. So we have to be still enough. When you're restless, stick, done that. Girl, done that. Sort of teddy bear, done that. When we are still, then we begin to see. And this is really important to understand that, to have that stillness. And this is where the restlessness has disappeared. So we can be still enough after a jhana. You can look at something for hours and totally never finish seeing it. Just like I said, that clump of bamboo story. For maybe 50 minutes, for 8 days, I was looking there, never finished with it. A simple clump of bamboo. Now let your body and mind, imagine looking at that for such a long time. Do you know your body? Do you know your mind? We're too restless to really know. So stillness is important. And that goes after a jhana. And also we have these other two parts of the hindrances, which is desire and ill will, which every psychologist would know. Desire, you know, wishful thinking. You see what you want to see. Because that's, you know, that's what we want to see. If you are the disciple of Ajahn Brahm, you only see my wisdom, you just cannot see my stupidity. Because you don't want to see that. If you hate somebody, you can only see the reasons which justify your hate, or your anger towards a person. Just like after the bhikkhuni ordination, anything I do would always be interpreted, you know, by your enemies as justifying. Yes, you see, he's a bad monk. He's got all these plans and stuff like that. This is a desire and ill will. Bend the truth to fit. You know, your desires, your wishful thinking, or your ill will called denial. We just can't see the truth. We bend it to suit ourselves. Now that's one of the problems. But once the hindrances are gone, you've got no desire left. You just see what's there. No denial, even if it's something which shocks you, which upsets you, you find out you're wrong. So what? You were wrong. Nothing wrong with that. So you find out the truth when you stop bending it with seeing what you want to see and just denying what's uncomfortable for you. That is why one of the first things the jhanas do is overcome the hindrances which stop you seeing clearly. Remember just Ajahn Brahmadi once saying, I said, yes, you've got it. Telling him that sort of that's the whole purpose of meditation, he was saying, was to overcome the five hindrances for long enough so you can see the truth. And jhanas are the only things which sap those hindrances, knock them out, and keep them out for long enough for you to see the Dhamma. This is the reason why people don't see the truth. You can read the suttas, you can actually listen to all the great monks and nuns in the whole world for all your life, you still don't understand it, simply because those hindrances are blocking you. Another simile, this was actually from Ajahn Chah, about the need for that stillness and simplicity of mind before you understand things. In the northeast of Thailand, the same with, you know, the forest monasteries in Sri Lanka. I remember going to some of the forest monasteries in Sri Lanka, exactly the same as the forest monasteries in Thailand. It was so nice to see this was, you know, just an international Buddhist tradition. And in those forests, you would have to spend a long time sweeping the paths through the jungle. And the reason you kept sweeping the paths, because if you didn't sweep them, then you'd have all these snakes and centipedes and stuff which would linger in there. You get bitten too often. But once you swept a path, you could actually see where you're going. If there's any obstacles like a snake in there, you could avoid it because, you know, you could see it. And, you know, we spent hours sweeping these paths. And because I was Westerner, perfectionist, you sweep a bit of path, and then a leaf would fall down, right in the path which you just swept. You know what I did? I turned around to sweep that leaf off. That was absolutely mad and crazy, because the leaves were always falling, which meant the path never got perfect. The Thai monks, they'd sweep, oh, that's good enough, we'll get that leaf tomorrow. They were much smarter, because, you know, they weren't perfectionists, it was good enough. But I remember Ajahn Chah saying, he said, it's amazing when you've got a clear path and one leaf falls onto that path, it really stands out, becomes very clear and easy to contemplate. But when a leaf falls in the forest with another 1,000 leaves all jumbled up, you can't really understand it, you can't see it. He said, for insight, you have to have a very clear path. A very still, empty mind. And then when something comes up, just one little simple thing, it can stay there, you're not distracted by other things, and you can understand it. The problem with us is there's so many leaves in our mind, we can't see one from the other. They're all jumbled up, which means we never understand it. So again, in this very simple, deep meditation, after we come out of these very still states, if anything arises, just one thing at a time, you're mostly empty, you have a chance to understand. But when it gets to the very deepest of insights, the ones which make you enlightened, have you ever wondered about this enlightenment business? Because I remember, this is again one of my little stories, I remember that being going to a school, which was a very good school, which had a chaplain, an Anglican chaplain at that school. And I was very respectful of all religions, but I was genuinely interested. And I wanted to actually to know, now this thing, God, what is it that we're supposed to believe in? And I remember going to him, making an appointment and just discussing, and that's what I wanted to know, what is God? And he told me that God is ineffable, beyond words, the ground of all being, the Alpha and Omega. And I said, what does that mean? And every time I asked him for something clear I could get my head around, it was just all this gobbledygook nonsense. You know, no, you can't ask it. It's beyond space and time. And I just couldn't understand that at all. And then that was one of the reasons I gave up that Christianity. I couldn't understand it. No one can give me a clear explanation. And when I became a Buddhist and I saw monks, I remember going to a monk in the Thai temple in London, Wat Buddha Pratipa, when it was in East Sheen. And I remember asking him, what is enlightenment, nibbana, what is it? And he said, it's beyond words. Beginning and end of everything. You know, I thought, I've heard that before. That's more gobbledygook. If I asked you, what is enlightenment? Would you be able to give me a clear answer? What the hell are you doing here then? You're following a path. You're getting on a bus whose destination you're not clear about. You don't know where it's going. And that was actually really worrying for me. You know, it's felt good, but you know, what is it? And when I get there, am I going to be happy I got on that bus and arrived? And that was some of the problems there. It was a lack of real clarity about what's going on. And that's one of the reasons why when you come to a great teacher like Ajahn Chah, when he explains these things, you can actually understand them. You understand what they really are. And now I've got on to this, you know, the classic description of enlightenment, you know, which everybody can understand. You can tell this to your kids and they will understand it. They may not want to get there, but at least they can understand what you're talking about. And again, that's a simile you've all heard probably, but some of you may have not. And it fits into the talk anyway, so here it comes again. And don't worry about hearing a simile again, because sometimes you haven't understood it properly yet, so it has to be repeated. And that's a simile of the old simile of the five kids playing the wishing game. Five children playing a wishing game. The rules are the kid who comes up with the best wish wins. First kid said, if I had a wish, I would wish for a new PlayStation with the latest video games, because you know, he likes playing video games. Fair enough. And the second guy, or the second kid, had more time to think. That's why if ever you have a contest like this, or a game, never be the first to answer. Wait, and you get much better information. Just like that old story of the rabbi, the priest, and the monk. Yes, a joke coming. A rabbi, a priest, and a monk. They were doing interfaith work. You know, in the West especially, how important it is for people from different religions to get together, to talk together, and to, you know, to get some harmony and understanding so we don't have so much violence in this world. So they started just meeting and discussing their different religions. And then they soon realized you just need more than words. You know, you got to bond together first of all. So they started playing some games. I know, for only three people, it's hard to find a game. So eventually they decided to play cards together. And then one thing led to another, they started playing poker. And only first of all for fun, but then it started getting serious for money. They were gambling. And in the place they did this, that was illegal. And the police found out, arrested them, and there they were in trial in a court of law. And the judge, he said these three defendants, the rabbi, the priest, and the monk, he said, look, you're all religious people. I'm not going to mess around with you. I'm just going to ask you in this court of law. First of all, the rabbi, were you gambling? And the rabbi did an old trick which I was taught when I was a schoolboy. You put your fingers behind your back and you cross them. And he said, no, I was not gambling. I don't know where that came from. So then it was the priest, the Christians. and he said, right, were you gambling? And the priest said quickly,
"Jesus, forgive me."
No. Because Jesus is very forgiving, so you can lie and just get forgiven afterwards. No. And then it was the monk's turn. And the priest said, "You know, I know that you keep these precepts, you won't lie. So, monk, were you gambling?" And the monk says, "With whom, Your Honor?" So that's why it's always good to be the last to answer. So the second kid said, "Well, if I had a wish, I would wish for a video game shop. If I owned the shop, I wouldn't just get one video game. I'll be able to get thousands of video games. Whenever the new one comes out, I'll be able to get it for free because I own the shop. A much better wish." And the third kid, much smarter, she said, now because she'd been thinking a bit longer, "If I had a wish, I would wish for $100 billion US. It's a lot of money, but it's a wish. Because with $100 billion US, I could buy not just a shop, a whole chain of video game stores. But the trouble, which every kid would understand, the trouble is my mother would not let me play video games until I've done my homework. So once I've bought my own video game shop, the next thing I'll buy is my own school. Because if I own the school and employ all the teachers, they will not give me any homework. Otherwise, I'll sack them because I own the school. And so I can graduate from my own school, giving myself the top marks because I own the joint. And then I will buy my own university and also give myself an honorary doctorate because I own the university. That way, I will not need to go to school. I can spend all my time playing video games and my mum won't be able to stop me. And if anything else I figure out I need later on in life, with $100 billion US, you will never, ever be able to spend that, unless you're a government. And it's amazing how quickly they can spend all of that. And so that was That was a big wish. And the fourth kid was far smarter than that. Saying 200 billion, that's the same as 100 billion. 100 billion is as much money as you can ever spend and more. So the fourth kid said, "If I had a wish, I would wish for 3 wishes." That's a wish. "For my first wish, I will have the video game store. Second wish, I'll have $100 billion US. And for my third wish, I will have 3 more wishes. That way I can go on forever." Beat that. And of course, that was an amazing wish. Infinity of wishes always given to you. Can you do better than that? And the last child won the wishing game. If you haven't heard this before, it's absolutely brilliant. The fifth child said, "If I had a wish I was so content I never needed any more wishes ever again." And they all agreed the fifth child had won. Contentment, the end of all wishes. So you don't need a wish anymore. It's far superior than all your wishes supplied. That is nirvana, enlightenment. The end of all wishes. So content, you don't need any more wishes. Being a billionaire, the third kid, that's not as good as being in power, which is why many billionaires join government. Now, here in Australia, we've got that Clive Palmer. Billion, more money they can ever spend. He became a politician. Why? Because power, having your wishes granted, is much, much better than having billions of dollars. So that's why many millionaires try to go into power and become presidents or dictators, so they can give all their wishes granted. But even better than that is being so content you don't need any more wishes. And that's enlightenment. Now you can understand what that is. And this is where you don't need anything. But it's so hard to let go of all your wishes. Even if you've got everything, you still want something more. It's crazy, isn't it? Why is that? And the reason why that is because we don't understand what craving and desire truly is. Number one, we think it's part of us. And number two, we think it's our best friend. That because of our will, our choices, our craving, we have got so much in life. Look what all my effort and striving has got for me. You think it's your friend. It can get rid of problems. The only trouble is, sometimes your craving and desire is a bit stupid. You keep making mistakes. You know, you crave the wrong thing. So you try and come here to be wise, so that your will can be smart will, and to not make wrong choices, so you can always, you know, get happiness and joy and health. Now that is the great myth of spiritual development. Thinking that will can somehow be trained to be clever and smart and provide you happiness and never any problems and suffering. The wise person eventually sees through insight the will itself is fundamentally flawed. It's not your friend, but it's your biggest enemy. And how the heck do you find that out? You only find that out through the great simile of the tadpole and the frog, which I have to say at every retreat is one of the best. Once upon a time, there was a little tadpole who was born in a wonderful lake next to a beautiful retreat center. And this little tadpole, she was a very, very clever tadpole. So in the lake, she went to tadpole school. And she always came top of the class, and she went to Tadpole High School, where she studied chemistry and did so well that she went to Tadpole University in the lake, where all the other tadpoles taught her about, you know, chemistry. And especially she learned in a university chemistry class about the nature of water, you know, the H2O, and even just how the molecule was formed, and just, you know, all the particular forces which held the molecule together. She became an expert on water in the lake. And she even went, there was a couple of bald-headed tadpoles who taught her the Abhidhamma on water and what, you know, the deeper meaning of water was. And even though so she studied the Abhidhamma on water and knew all the chemical properties of water, do you think that tadpole understood what water was? How can a tadpole understand water when she's been born in water, grew up in water, lived all her life in water? A tadpole cannot understand water no more than a fish can. But the difference between a tadpole and a fish is one day, little tadpole, she grows arms and legs. Something weird starts to happen. And one day, she wakes up, she's a frog. And playing around, not knowing what she's doing, she jumps and she's out of the lake, standing on the banks on dry land for the very first time in her life. This is weird. She's never had anything like this before. Which is why when you have weird states, don't be afraid, don't throw them away. Weirdness works. Weirdness is awesome. From weirdness we get the biggest insights. Weird is cool. So, weird states, she's sitting on dry land. Never before has she experienced anything like that before. Many frogs, when they first jump up, they go back inside again because they're afraid. But real frogs, they jump up and they stay outside. Yeah, it's weird, it's a bit strange, but it's actually quite nice. And after a little while, do you think the frog has to contemplate and say, I'm on dry land, now I will do insight? It doesn't have to do that. It's obvious. Something is missing. Something which has always been there, ever since the little frog, or before the Taupo can remember, is now gone. What was that? Water. Water is now vanished. And now all those things which little Taupo learnt at school, the university, and in the meditation sessions held in the pond, now the frog can understand what water is only when it's vanished. Now, that simile, you little tadpoles, some of you have been growing little legs, you're about to jump out, you jump out and get into these jhanas. Weird, but amazing. And when you're in those jhanas, afterwards you realize something's missing. Something which has always been here, ever since I can remember, is no longer there, it's totally gone. One of those things is your will, choice, the ability to move, to think, to do things. It's not there anymore, totally vanished. I don't mean you're not exercising your will. Many times you just sit here, you don't do anything, but you can if you want to. Now you can't even if you did want to. The will has totally vanished, just like the water has vanished for the frog. That is weird. But now, at last, for the first time, you can understand what this will is. It's not you. It's not yours. You did not decide to come on this retreat. You think you did? And it's obvious you did. It's obviously you'll choose what you're going to eat for lunch today. Nah, that's wrong. It just appears that way. Now I'm stirring you up big time, I hope. And what you realize, this will doesn't belong to you at all, and it's also a pain in the neck, this will, because when it goes, you're so peaceful, and everything will promise to get for you. You just get me wise, you indulge me, effort, will, striving. You just give me free rein, and I'll provide you with happiness, eternity, bliss, whatever you want. It's just, I don't will strong enough. That's what will tries to say. Come on, strive and don't give up, and then you'll get to your goals. That's what will lies to you and convinces you. And will says, well, maybe I've made a few mistakes, but because I need to be a bit more wise, give me some more information, and then I'll get what you want. And will never gets you that. It promises everything you ever wanted, never supplies it. All the striving you've been doing, are you finished yet? Have you reached the end? Are you so content you don't need any more will? No. Bodhinyana Monastery is not finished yet. Jhana Grove, there's still many things to do. Dhammasara, you've only just started. It's going to go on until you die. There's always things to do there. Your house, your little house, is it finished yet? You know, your poor husband's on the weekend, you've got to fix the gutters, put the carpet in, do this and do that. And there's always stuff going on in the house, and it just goes, you're crazy. My house is supposed to be where I rest. I go to work. When I come home on the weekend, I want to hang out. No, so many things to do. You've got to do the washing, you've got to do the cooking. You've cooked, as soon as you've cooked one meal, you've got to wash up. As soon as you're washed up, you've got to start cooking the next meal. Oh, it's endless. So we always think if we could only have a smarter will, then we could have more peace. It doesn't work that way. Now you see what the will is. You see the lie the will gives you. And everything it ever promised you and never supplied, when the will vanishes, you have it all. Peace, contentment, nothing missing, nowhere needed to go, nothing to be done. Perfect peace at last, when your will vanishes. That's why it feels like bliss. Or that's why many people say it's unconditional love. By unconditional love, they mean perfect acceptance. They don't have to change at all. They don't have to strive to be better. There is nothing missing. There is no goals to be reached. There is no journey to be commenced or completed. This beautiful, perfect love. The perfection means nothing to do anymore. And that's how many people experience those states. That's what love really means. At last, I don't need to be different. Somebody accepts me for who I am, and I don't need to do all this striving, all this studying at school to better myself, coming to a retreat to try and improve myself, doing something to going to a spa to make myself more beautiful, going to a gym to make myself more healthy. I gave up on that a long time ago, trying to be healthy. I'm good enough as I am. This is who I am. This is who I'll be, and don't try and change me. Fat is good. as I said the other day, being cheeky and not a bar, fat is the new sexy. You can be outrageous as a mug, it's good fun. So you just be yourself, for goodness sake. That's what love really is, so you have a great time and be at peace at last. Now that's what happens when you get into the jhana. Those are the insights which knock you around and you realize just how much you've been wasting your time for your whole life trying to be better, trying to be wise, trying to fix up things instead of trying to let things be. The will is seen at last for what it truly is. Your enemy, not your friend. That's radical stuff. And I can say this, I can speak about it, for too long. But it's not my fault, I didn't have any choice going over time. But it all means absolutely nothing. Yeah, it's interesting, you think about it, you can say, I agree with that. No, you can find all the faults with it. Come and argue with me, but Ajahn Brahm. So actually the talk is nothing. But this is what's going to happen to you. You're going to get into these jhanas, whether you like it or not. You're going to be a frog, and these things are going to vanish. And this is going to be so weird. And in that weirdness, that experience, you're going to get insights which change the whole way you look at your life. No more will you think that will or craving is going to lead to happiness. But the letting go of will, letting go of craving, peace at last, so content, you don't need any more desires or will. That is enlightenment. Now you know why we do these things. You may not agree with it, you may not be there, but at least you have some understanding of it, and it's no more gobbledygook about the beginning and end of all things and the ground of all being and all this sort of rubbish stuff. I know what ground is, I know what being is, but the ground of being, I'll never be able to figure that one out. It sounds good though. Be careful. What sounds good and incomprehensible, don't think that's wise. That's people criticize me. Ajahn Brahm is just too easy to understand, it cannot be profound. Yes, it damn well is. So anyway, happy meditation. Hopefully you vanish and disappear. And then you can actually see who's running this show called you. Sadhu! Sadhu!